This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking with novelist Colson Whitehead. His first novel was The Intuitionist. It was a story about a woman who worked in a city very much like New York as an elevator inspector, and about some of the tension between two rival schools of thought when it comes to inspecting elevators. The empiricists, those are the people who pretty much just believed in the things that they could touch and hold in their hands, and the intuitionists, those people who went about their work by feeling. And it was the hero, the lead character, Lila Mae Watson, who was indeed an intuitionist. That book got a lot of positive attention, is still available. It's now available in paperback if you'd like to read it, and I think it's a good book. This morning, though, we'll talk with Colson Whitehead about his new novel, which is titled John Henry Days. It has just recently been published. It's published by Doubleday, and again, like The Intuitionist, is getting a lot of positive attention. We'll tell you a little bit about the story or stories that run through the book and talk about writing with Colson Whitehead. And as we do that, anyone who's listening certainly can call in if you have questions of your own. All we ask is people just try to be brief so we can keep things moving along. But, of course, anyone's welcome to join the conversation. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is, and if it would be a long-distance call for you, you can use that number. We'll pay for the call. And that's 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL, that's what you get if you match the numbers and the letters, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL at any point here. If you want to call in, you're welcome to do that. Mr. Whitehead, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks. Thanks for talking with us.
That was a pleasure.
We appreciate it. There's a lot going on in this book, but probably the simplest way to start out talking about the stories that run through is to talk a little bit about the main character, the man named Jay Sutter, who is a freelance journalist from New York who ends up traveling to West Virginia to cover an event that honors and celebrates John Henry. And it's happening because the Postal Service has created a series of stamps honoring American folk heroes, and John Henry is one of them. And so that is what the title, John Henry Days, refers to.
Right, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about this guy, Jay.
Well, he's a very, very hacky journalist. He's part of a group of, I call them junketeers, and they'll cover any media event, no matter how small, no matter how insignificant, as long as they can get free drinks and free food at the press event, free sneakers if it's like a new kind of sneaker that's being promoted. And I dispatched five of these junketeers to cover this dinky event in Talcott, West Virginia, where they're unveiling this postage stamp. And Jay Sutter, he's been, I guess, a junketeer for a couple years, but he's engaged in a contest where he's going for the record of junketeering, which is the most consecutive days of covering crappy media events in a row. So he's 3 months into his junketeering jag, and he finds himself in Talcott, West Virginia, which is the town named in most of the John Henry ballads.
Mm-hmm. And he is compared in the book to another junketeer who tried to do something like this before, or at least he set the record that existed and became unhinged in the process. So everybody's kind of looking at Jay and wondering, is this guy, what's going to happen to this guy if he keeps on like this?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a existential sort of contest he's in. The previous record holder, Bobby Figgis, sort of went mad and disappeared after 9 months of junketeering and covering these tiny events. So he gets a lot of flack from the fellow junketeers over what exactly his mission is and what he's trying to accomplish by doing this. Mm.
These guys feel very real to me, which maybe suggests that you know some people like this?
Not really. I mean, it's more from just being a critic over a couple years. For about 5 years, I worked at the Village Voice covering music and books and TV and film. And you just get acquainted with the ebb and flow of media and publicity. So you know that someone's first effort, a first novelist, the first filmmaker gets a certain kind of brand of hype. Their return with their second book or film or album gets another kind of media attention. There's the comeback. There's the downfall. So I just from just observing these things over time, I became a little too familiar with the way publicity happens.
Yeah. Well, there's a wonderful bit of business in the book where they're talking about how these kinds of stories fall into one of four. Everything can be reduced into one of a handful of categories, and they are, as you explained, they give this generic guy the name Bob. So the stories are all about Bob, and it's Bob's debut, Bob's return, Bob's comeback, and it's their sort of cynical way of saying, well, basically everything boils down to just a handful of themes, and we're just doing the same, churning out the same stuff over and over again.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's kind of funny because New York Magazine was going to cover my new book, but they had to be really self-conscious about it because they were kind of implicated in that sort of paradigm of this is how we treat a second a second novel from somebody. So the writer, who's a very nice guy, was just very self-conscious about. This is a Bob's return piece, and it was just kind of funny.
Well, and it also it certainly invites a lot of speculation, a lot of thinking about within popular journalism now on all levels, including the internet, how much is written and created about stuff that really doesn't matter, is not terribly important, and an awful lot of words being churned out about nothing, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, I was in New York in the early '90s, and I was part of the web content boom, where basically you could be unemployed for many years, and then suddenly you get a random web content job for a website you never heard of, that no one ever went to, but they were paying $2 a word or $1 a word, and it was just really ridiculous. I got a job with some friends who were web designers to do a comic for TVGuide.com. And it was just a comic, it was a web comic. And it took me half an hour to write. I get paid $500. And then when it debuted, no one ever went there. So they're trying to figure out how to make money off of it. So I was supposed to mention movies, like characters would make offhand references to movies. And then you could click on the movie and then go to the TV Guide listings and when it's coming on. So it's kind of, and after like 6 issues, we were canceled because it was just a very meaningless operation. But I certainly lived off the money, and I never went to the site. But this is very weird external kind of condition.
Mm-hmm. Well, I read this little essay that you wrote about that. The essay titled "I Worked in an Ill-Conceived Internet Startup and All I Got Was This Lousy Idea for a Novel," which actually was a good idea for a novel. But you apparently were doing this thing and it didn't require that much time during the day, so you ended up spending some time surfing. And I know that you, this interest in John Henry goes back away, and we can talk about that too. But that seems, this was after The Intuitionist was finished and either hadn't been published yet or hadn't quite taken off yet, and you were trying to make some money to survive, and that's when you again started thinking about John Henry and collecting information, and that's really where this book gets its start.
Yeah, I mean, I just finished the book and took a web content cataloging job to pay off the bills, and it was a lot of downtime, and I was trying to think of what to do next, and I'd always really been drawn to the John Henry story, so I just started doing web searches. And at that point, I had no idea that there was some sort of historical basis to the story. For those who don't remember, the legend goes that John Henry was a steel driver on the railroad in the 1870s, and he's the biggest, baddest steel driver around. And one day the company buys a steam drill, which will replace him and his men. And John Henry, in a fit of hubris or something else, challenges the engine to a race. And he beats it. He drives farther and faster than the machine and then keels over dead. So I got the idea to, I guess, update it for the information age. That was just a basic idea. But I do nothing. And so I'd plug in John Henry to various search engines. And it turned out that the post office had made this John Henry stamp. That's like the real life event that the novel takes off of. And they're going to hold the stamp ceremony, the unveiling of the stamp ceremony in Pittsburgh, but the home of steel and railroads. But Talcott, West Virginia, called up and they were incensed. They were like, John Henry's our hometown boy. And that's where I found out that the Big Bend Tunnel, which is named in a lot of the ballads, is a real-life tunnel, and it's in Talcott, West Virginia. And people in the town sort of hold, sort of maintain that he really existed, the race was real, and it's not just a made-up legend. So that gave me a more factual basis than just a few verses to work from.
Yeah, so there really is a John Henry stamp, and there really is a John Henry Day celebration that takes place in Talcott, West Virginia.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been to theirs. I assume it's a lot more smaller than the one I would describe. It's just like sort of a crafts fair. But it takes off from, yeah, that first small John Henry Days and then concocts this a bigger media event out of it that I could dispatch these junketeer anti-heroes to. Mm.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with novelist Colson Whitehead. His new novel is John Henry Days, and it's published by Doubleday. His previous novel, The Intuitionist, is also out, certainly still out there. It's in paperback now, if you'd like to read it. And your questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Just kind of as a side note, I think in the book, at some point, someone's talking about John Henry and explains the fact that most people don't really know what it is he did. They have this idea that he was laying railroad track, and I guess I probably kind of thought that too. But in fact, what these people were doing was they were using metal bits and sledgehammers to drill a hole into rock that then would be filled with explosives and blown up as a way of their, what they were doing was they're literally blasting a tunnel through a mountain.
Yeah, and it was, you know, it was very hazardous work. A lot of deaths from cave-ins, I mean, the conditions were pretty terrible. Most of the workers were freed slaves, and they, you know, they were paid pennies a day. I guess in regard to the job itself, the steel driver drives the drill bit into the rock, and there's a guy called a shaker who has to be a very brave soul who holds the drill bit horizontal for the hammer to hit. And if his hands are in the wrong place, you know, they'll be mangled. And between each blow, he has to spin the drill bit so that the dust inside gets loose. He has to exchange like a 3-foot bit for a 6-foot bit without missing a beat, or else, you know, he gets smashed. So I guess driving stakes seems a lot more glamorous, or like you're advancing foot by foot and making a transatlantic railroad. But what John Henry actually did, his real job was it was pretty terrible.
Yeah. So in the book, there's this scene in a school classroom where a teacher shows to the children a cartoon version, an animated version of the life of John Henry.
Yeah.
And this is based on your own experience. Was this happened when you were a kid and you were in school? The teacher hauls out this John Henry cartoon, and that was kind of your first exposure to John Henry.
Yeah. You know, it was the early '70s, and it was the start of the multicultural kind of education in the school systems. So I'm not sure if it was an English class or a history class, but the teacher reeled in a projector and showed us a 20-minute movie on John Henry. And I was immediately taken with seeing a black superhero for the first time. It's pretty rare then. It's pretty rare now. And you know, in the years to follow, the story stayed with me, but I still had no idea what the story meant. And is it a triumph for the individual against industry? Is it a triumph for the community? Is he preserving humanity? I still don't know after finishing the book, but there's a lot of different kind of interpretations you can make about the ambiguous ending of him dying after accomplishing this goal.
Yeah, the big question is he won the contest, but he died. So the big question is, well, did he win or did he lose?
Yeah, I mean, is he a sacrifice for the culture? Is he just being punished for his hubris? There are all sorts of different interpretations, and part of what I was trying to do was have different characters have their own interaction with the John Henry legend, so that you get all these different kinds of interpretations over time, and he means different things to different people in different time periods and different professions and different backgrounds. So that's what part of what I was trying to do.
Mm-hmm. So we have these two figures, Jay, the writer, and John Henry. And John Henry is this figure, this epic figure involved in this epic struggle. And one can talk about different sorts of things that the struggle is about. Certainly, it's on one level, it is this man-machine thing, probably about a lot of other things, too. And Jay, he is on his own quest. He's involved in what passes, I guess, for an epic struggle. That is, he's trying to set this record.
Right.
And yet the two things, when we set them next to one another, seem the road he's on seems so, when what he's doing seems so much smaller in a sense, and he seems so much smaller. It's sort of ridiculous to put the two together, and yet in a way it seems to be saying that this is about all you can do in our time to try and do something that seems at all heroic.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of superhuman contest doesn't really exist anymore. I mean, I think, if it ever did, I think today we kind of have our own individual machines that we're struggling against. And I think for Jay, it's how to be a writer in a very corrupt media landscape. In different chapters, I have different characters across the century who have their own sort of John Henry contest. So, in the 30s, it's a blues singer who's a town-to-town folk singing tradition will go by the wayside with the rise of the record player. So he really wants to get on vinyl and get his name among the pantheon of people, of other blues singers who are getting on records. So he has his own sort of machine, literally, and then a larger struggle, with his creative life. There's a Tin Pan Alley songwriter who's putting the John Henry ballad on sheet music for the first time. And sheet music, was the first, one of the first ways that we forged a national pop culture. People are always in their drawing rooms buying the latest thing, the latest ditty in Harper's or Munsey's, whatever the magazines were back then. And he's struggling to get his name out there and have a million seller and keep his wits about him in a tenement on the Lower East Side in the early part of the century. So I think, as the world gets older and the nation gets older, those kind of contests become rarer and rarer, and we have to sort of hunt and find our own contests. Because they're out there, but we don't see them as heroic as such, but in some ways they kind of are. Hmm.
We're approaching the midpoint of the program, and our guest this morning is novelist Colson Whitehead. His new novel is John Henry Days. It's published by Doubleday, and his first, The Intuitionist, is also available now in paper. And if you'd like to read the books, and I think they're both very good. And, of course, if you'd like to call in, you can talk with our guest, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Your main character, we never learn what his first name is. He's just always referred to as Jay. How come this poor guy doesn't get a name?
He has a name. It's just
We don't know.
Yeah. I apologize for any confusion.
That's all right. just have something to do with his, in a sense, being a kind of an enigmatic blank sort of a figure, kind of a cipher in a way?
I think it feeds into that. I think there's some other sort of interpretation you can spin out of it. Definitely not the Jesus thing. He's not a Christ figure. So mm-hmm. Stay away from the J initial as a Jesus thing. But I think it works. I guess I don't feel. I think it's hard to go into it, but I think it's sort of truncated moniker. I think it works.
I guess I found myself wondering whether, in fact, his name was John. Is John?
Yes, one could possibly wonder about something like that. Yeah, that's definitely there.
So how the intuition was very well received, got a lot of favorable press, a lot of attention directed towards you as being a very successful first novelist. Of course,
right.
That puts a great deal of pressure on you for the second book, because there will be people who are waiting to say, you see, this guy was just a flash in the pan, and he really didn't have the real stuff.
Right.
How has your life changed as a result of the fact that the books have been as successful as they have been?
Well, I think with in terms of writing John Henry, I guess the bad thing about the publishing process is that it takes about a year for a book from when you hand it in to when it comes out. But the good thing, and you're impatient because it's your first book. But the good thing is that I was well into John Henry by the time the first book came out. So it wasn't a question of, I'm paralyzed by the great reception and the good reviews. How do I follow it up? It was more a question of, I have this book. I know who all the characters are. It's halfway done. I just have to get back to work and finish it off. I'm definitely glad that John Henry's gotten the kind of reviews it's had and the exposure. Because basically, you just want people to hear about it and know that it's out there, and they can approach or retreat. But at least they know it's out there. It's funny because it just came out in bookstores 2 weeks ago. I did my first reading 2 days ago in Minneapolis, and that kind of makes the book real for me. Like doing a reading and seeing people come out and reading to them, they're responding. Reviews come out and it's still kind of abstract that the book's out there and it's in bookstores, but you're kind of used to seeing the cover. Hmm. But so I'm still getting used to John Henry days just being out and in the world and, talking to people about it and stuff like that. So I'm not sure how I feel like a month from now.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, because I would guess that there is a big difference. You create something, you work on it for a long time, it exists as a manuscript, but then when it actually gets to the point where it's something you can hold in your hands, it somehow becomes something different.
Yeah, it has a pretty solid solid weight in your hand, and the typeface is there, and your cruddy font from your computer is gone that you were so sick of staring at. And you start talking to people about it again after a year, and finding things, good parts to read at readings. And you become reacquainted with it, and it becomes, in some ways a new book. You kind of forget certain paragraphs, like, that was a really good paragraph. I kind of forgot that was there. You're proud of yourself. certain things that you forget as time goes on, you're reminded of, and you're like, it was actually a really fun, great experience to write the book. Mm.
So are you still carrying with you your copy of American Standard Practice for Elevator Inspection?
I'm so sick of
See, that's actually was sort of my reason for asking, because I'm sure that it gets to the point where no matter how good you think something is and what a great achievement it was and how much you love it, and other people will love it and continue to discover it, they will get to the point where you figure, enough of the elevator thing. I don't want to talk about it anymore.
Well, like I was saying about finishing something and then it's published a year later, there's a real distance between writing the thing and then other people seeing it. So, definitely when I'm done writing, I can, I'm fond of it, but like, I don't really want to hear the John Henry song again. I don't want to, and whenever I step in the elevator, I'm reminded, and it's sort of like, I want to move on.
Yeah.
So I think next, I think elevators are a little too commonplace to escape from, so I think, I'll try to stay away from the mundane, I guess.
Well, I have now, in two different things I've read, you read this comment from you that said you were working on a novel about Band-Aids. Now, was this a joke, or is this...
No, it's kind of, it's pretty true. I mean, there's definitely some Band-Aids in it, and they play a part. I mean, it's pretty early to, talk about it too much. But it's not so much about Band-Aids that I can never wear an adhesive bandage and stay away from hospitals again.
Hmm.
But it does take off from sort of the idea of flesh-colored Band-Aids and what color is flesh.
That was my thought exactly, because in one of these references it just said Band-Aids and the other it said flesh-colored, and of course my first thought was, oh yeah, what color is that?
Yeah, and the crayon boxes, I think they stopped it, but there's like a crayon color called flesh.
When we were kids,
really match my flesh.
Yes, there was, and now I think they call that peach or something like that. They don't call that flesh anymore.
They don't call it Anglo-American
of European. European. No, they don't. It wouldn't fit on the wrap on the crayon. It would just be too long. Well, I'd like to give people the opportunity to hear a little bit of John Henry Days. So, would you read something?
Sure. I'm going to read, the opening of the John Henry Days Fair itself, the county fair. All the characters are down there, and people are assembling for this afternoon of fun and delight. So here we go. They come out of cars, out of vehicles hot from sunlight and conveying engines. The hoods tick cool. Parking is a hassle, nose to nose, on weeds, almost in ditches, on crumbling terraces of asphalt unstable because rainwater has swept the dirt from under. Passengers are reminded by other passengers to roll up the windows. The father surveys and orders the son to put the camera under the seat. Locks are locked, are double-checked, sometimes by remote control with beeps. Somebody forgot something in the car. Sunglasses nestle over ears, snug on the scalp. Mud flaps. The cars move slowly. There are too many people on the road. Little kids not looking where they're going, and it's a creeping progress. Those who have found parking spaces view these drivers with a certain superiority. Then they take a few steps and get lost in the fair. Portable equipment has been hauled to the grounds. One look at the line for the Porto Sands, and you reconsider your need. The line for the men's is always shorter, discernible from the line for the women's, an inspiration for many identical observations about biological equipment, repeated over the course of the day by many different people. Some men sneak off into the woods, by the bandstand, toward the middle of the grounds. A generator rattles. The amps have already been tested. A man was sent to fetch tape to tape down orange industrial cable where a child might trip or an old lady break a hip. Along the sides of the bandstand, black sheeting is taped up to keep people from seeing the fragile-looking scaffolding. Some kids will sneak in there when no one is looking and peek through at the people. A quarter mile of steel fencing separates the tracks from the grounds, and several guards patrol the space between all day, per the agreement with the railroad. No one wants a regrettable incident. The day before, the registered vendors match lot numbers with marked territory and learn the pecking order. Of course, some favoritism is to be expected, and those who registered late are penalized with less than optimum placement. Those with plum spots feel something that draws itself up to contentment. Some try to come up with ways to beat the system. It's quite a thing to stand there the day before the fair and see the land sectioned off like that by strings and stakes in three long rows. They can hardly believe the day is almost here. The people who will come the next day will move from booth to booth. It is important to have a flashy sign to draw them in, and the next day some of the vendors will return with paint on the flesh that has resisted turpentine. Many of the vendors have never met before and extend greetings while checking out their neighbor's wares. No one wants to be next to a booth that will be a turnoff. Put all that effort in, and then something like that happens out of your control. One booth will have some kind of trick to draw people over, and the neighbors think, why didn't I think of that? Mostly friendly, but then it's dog-eat-dog on some level.
Hmm. Colson Whitehead, reading from his new novel, John Henry Days. It's published by Doubleday. His first, The Intuitionist, got a lot of favorable attention, won a number of awards. It's available in paper if you'd like to read it, and questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. And one of the things that I feel I experience when I have read your books is that, on the one hand, there's a momentum that propels me through the sentences, and at the same time, they're very loaded. There's lots of stuff there that makes me want to, once I've gone through, to go back and say, well, anyway, I want to go over that again. How do you approach writing, and do you do a lot of revising? Is it a laborious process?
It's funny because I guess my work habits generally, I kind of work really hard for 6 months and then burn out and just chill and veg for another 6 months and then go back to work. So I guess when I'm working, I'm doing a bunch of hours a day, 5 days a week. And I get a lot done. And then in terms of revising, I just revise here and there, and over time, the sentences turn out okay. I guess one day I'll turn back to a chapter and just fix a comma or delete a word, and then a month later go back to the same chapter and take out a clause. And then you finish and you kind of, it happens that, things worked out okay in the end. You sort of revise over time, and they work themselves out, it seems. It seems to me.
In the New Yorker, John Updike wrote about you and your books. And I'm interested in your reaction to just one thing he says in the piece, where he notes that talks about the book taking its name from John Henry. But here's what Updike says. He says, the book takes its name from John Henry, epitome of black strength and heartbreak, but its central character, the disgusted junketeer Jake Sutter, need not be black at all. His discontent might just as well be that of a young white or Asian American of literary bent. And I wonder what you think about that, because I don't think I agree with Mr. Updike here. I'm not sure this would be the same book. Or for that matter, you would be the same writer if you and Jay were not African American.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about that review is that there's definitely some kind of there's definitely a generational and racial divide between me and Updike, and it came across in different parts of the book. Later on, he goes to say that he's talking about Frederick Douglass and James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison, and sort of complaining that Jay Sutter's problems are not as big as sort of pre-civil rights figures' problems. And the gist was kind of like, I kind of thought black writing was more interesting when they're really struggling a lot. And so at different points in the review, I've got to step back and just say, he's sort of missing key parts of the book. Jay Sutter is a middle-class black man from New York, and he's not Bigger Thomas, and he's not the Invisible Man. And but it doesn't mean that his struggles aren't as deep or as interesting. Perhaps he's not an escaped slave, but these are different times, and the struggles of assimilation are different. But no less sort of deep and intriguing than a pre-civil rights struggle. So, it's a strange review in different ways.
Yeah, it is. I guess I wasn't. At the end of it, I guess I wasn't sure that I understood what exactly he did feel about the book, because it was I don't know. I suppose you could take it as a kind of a backhanded compliment, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, in a lot of reviews, some people find the story of Jay Sutter's Odyssey during the weekend more compelling. Then other people find the historical chapters with Paul Robeson or the Blues Guy or the six chapters dealing with John Henry more compelling. And then some people who are, you know, of course my ideal readers, you know, like both and, you know, can see how those two strands play off each other and accent and get into the contrapuntal energy of the book.
Yeah. Well, there is it's some of the things I read about the book make reference to the Odyssey, and I guess there is something of that in this story, and I suppose also some people would resist the comparison, and that's sort of, you know, comparing Jay and his experiences to the Odyssey is kind of like saying that the Odyssey was about a guy who had a really long commute on the way home from work. but I do see some parallels there between the one journey and these others that are in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. You know, it's always strange when people compare the book to different other books, and sometimes you can see the comparison, sometimes you can't. But you know, I'm trying to find. Not necessarily a modern tale of heroism, but try to consider what a primal tale like the John Henry struggle can mean today, and where do we fit in, and can we fit in, and where we overlap and where we don't, and just sort of find my way through the story as someone who's writing in the year 2000.
The other reference, and now, I guess I've read too many things now. I don't know where I read them anymore. Oh, I guess it was the review that was in the New York Times that also, in addition to making reference to Ulysses, makes reference to Moby Dick.
Right.
Do you see that on some level, John Henry Days is a story of obsession on that level?
Yeah, and I think also just the sheer Americanness of it. It's the structure is hard for some people because instead of the more direct plot of the intuitionist, which was playing off detective conventions, in John Henry I have a more thematic plot, I guess, where each new chapter, a new character that pops up, is extending the narrative of an idea of John Henry as opposed to people running around and various crises happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it does have more, there are many more, in John Henry Days, there are many more stories going on. So you're, and I imagine this is a technical point, but makes it a more difficult kind of thing, trying to write a book like this and managing to juggle all those different stories.
Yeah, I mean, you spend a lot of time thinking about the structure of balancing a shorter chapter with a longer chapter. How long can we go without seeing Jay Sutter and the events of that weekend? So on a purely matter of technique, you're thinking about how the reader is going to respond to it. Because for me, I could have the book in any old order, and it would just still be my book. But you are trying to communicate ideas to other people, and you have to take that into account. One of the fun things about once the book is done, you can see how things have played out, and you can move things around. Because I always start with a pretty solid outline that changes over time, but I know what I'm doing. But since I didn't write the book from first chapter to last chapter, it wasn't it wasn't done until I was completely done. So for 6 months. Pages 200 to 300 were missing, and then once you have all the chapters, you can arrange them into something that makes sense, or your outline is kind of outmoded because the rhythm doesn't take into account the rhythm of the stories. So you spend a long time thinking of how people, the best way to get the arc of the story across to people.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Colson Whitehead. His most recent novel is John Henry Days, published by Doubleday. It's now out in hardcover. It's been out just a couple weeks. He's also the author of another book that's titled The Intuitionist. That was his first published novel, and it's in paperback. I think Anchor is the publisher of that book, and they're both out there if you want to read them. And, of course, if questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Just I'm going back to this Updike quote that I mentioned. There also was one of the things that came with the book was the transcript of a conversation you sat down and talked with Walter Mosley, who's written a lot of good books and was the creator of the character Easy Rawlins and some others. And at one point in here, you're having this conversation about the issue of being a black writer or being referred to as a black writer and how you feel about that and whether you'd rather just be said to be a writer rather than having that extra thing thrown in there for whatever it means.
Yeah, it's a very strange issue. In the 60s, you know, with the rise of nationalism, you're a black writer, and that's a political cry. And then over time, it becomes it's kind of like the N-word. It depends like who's saying it and in what context. I think in the Updike piece, the first sentence is the young African American writer to watch, maybe Colson Whitehead, mm-hmm. and then so I'm being ghettoized. But then if it was like Walter Mosley, I'd be like, we're black writers and we're writing in this black tradition, and we're taking our cues from what's gone before. So it's sort of like if someone said, "Are you a black writer?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm a black writer." And then in terms of bookstores, it becomes a separate issue of, are you being put in a black literature section and not in a literature section? And what does that mean? Like, how do you people find your books? So it's a really strange issue of how you see yourself and then how other people see you and what it means.
Well, it seems to me that when you are compared to other contemporary writers, you're not being compared to black writers. And do you somehow see yourself, to use the phrase you used, as being part of a black writing tradition? And if so, what writers do you feel that you're connected to?
I think definitely to Ellison and Ishmael Reed. I discovered them both in college, and they had a profound influence. Like I said, the first thing of Ellison I read was in elementary school, and they'd excerpted the opening scene of Invisible Man, and I didn't read the novel till later. But at that point, I'd only read I had read any black fiction, and it was really kind of eye opening the way he could veer from extreme naturalism to this these absurd riffs and this absurdist view of American life in the 50s. And then as I got older and in college, like Ishmael Reed with his various conspiracies and also absurd kind of riffing on conventions of the Western novel and detective novel. I think I learned a lot from that and was able to assemble my own voice from these various towering figures.
We have a couple of callers, and we're getting real short on time, so I want to try to get them in.
Okay.
First caller here is Champagne. It's line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. And really enjoying the program and enjoying the discussion. I had a question about the process of being a writer and also, I guess, being an African-American writer. How much do you, in your work, do you feel you've sort of confronted the issue of, and really the previous discussion touches on this, but you deal with the issue of what is realistic, what is representative? I'm in the process, I guess, of thinking about for quite a while writing a bit of a historical novel, and I'm struggling with the issue of how much to really sort of reflect what was true of African-American history as we know it or as we think about it, versus how to extend beyond that. So how have you sort of struggled with that in dealing with these various eras in your current work?
I guess I always find history is a lot more interesting than fiction. So, you can't really make up stuff as crazy as, say, Paul Robeson performing in a really racist production of John Henry in 1942 on Broadway. That's a crazy out of this world event, which I talk about in the book.
Yeah.
And when I came across it, it fed into a lot of different themes in the book, and definitely I think it improved the book in the end. I guess there's in terms of realism, there's say a very realistic take on this on slavery in say Beloved, and then there's Ishmael Reed's Flight to Canada, and one is horribly affectingly naturalistic, and the other is plays slavery as farce and as a kind of adventure, the flight from slavery as a kind of adventure novel. So it sort of depends on what kind of writer you are and what kind of tools you're going to use and what you're trying to say, I think.
Well, would you say, I guess, that the, and this would be my last question, would you say that Langston Hughes's sort of reference to the, the Negro artist, or in this case, Negro writer and the racial mountain, do you still think that confronts, writers and the idea of having to be representative, having to be, again, I guess, in using the word realistic?
I feel like other people, other writers sort of are doing more traditional, have more traditional characters. I mean, now you have the rise of the B-boy and B-girl novel. You have these kind of romances where things are a lot more realistic than they are in my novel. I tend to take very strange characters and insert them into very odd situations and see and use them as a way of talking about race and talking about culture. So I take a kind of roundabout way of talking about race and blackness and what it means to be black in the early part of the 21st century. And I think that's more just coming out of the fight to the black arts movement and the early 70s, and those people sort of freed us up to try different things and not feel we have to do a certain kind of thing. We're not the one black writer of the moment. We're just, we have a lot more leeway in doing our own kind of strange tales, I think.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the call. And I am afraid, I'm sorry to say, we have somebody we can't take because we're at the end of the time and we're going to have to stop. I want to say to you, Mr. Whitehead, thanks very, very much for giving some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Oh, no, it was a lot of fun. Thanks a lot.
Our guest, Colson Whitehead, and his novel, if you'd like to read it, his newest, is John Henry Days. It's published by Doubleday. It's out now, just been out a couple of weeks in the hardcover, and you can also read his previous novel, The Intuitionist. It is available in paperback.